quite transformative for many people, and very meaningful. And so I wanted to take a couple of the ideas that I talked about a little bit during the retreat and talk about them again and maybe try to expand on them a little bit. And a little bit it describes the process, one way of looking at the process by which spiritual life, spiritual practice unfolds. So first is an analogy, which I taught there. I've taught various times before, and maybe I've taught it here. If you want to go and be a nature photographer in the savannas of Africa, you would apparently be fairly foolish to go around with your camera, walking all over, searching out the animals all over. You spend a lot of time looking and looking, and you might find some, but you have spent a lot of time kind of on your feet, on your jeep, or whatever way you're traveling, looking. And some of the animals are quite shy and maybe nocturnal and difficult to see. But the wise way of taking pictures of animals, if all you want is a picture of the animal, not how they behave in their habitat, is you would sit by the watering hole. And all animals eventually come to the watering hole. They all need to drink. So if you sit at the water hole and wait day and night, all the various animals will come, and you can then take your pictures behind your camouflaged little hut or whatever way you have. So that's the easy way, just sitting at the watering hole. And to apply that analogy to Buddhist practice puts a lot of emphasis on suffering, the importance of suffering. Part of the reason for the emphasis is that Buddhist practice is focused on alleviating that suffering. So if you went to your doctor and with some problem that ailed you, and the doctor wanted to know about your golf score, and wanted to know about what the weather was like on the day you were born, and wanted to know about your second cousin, after a while you would be concerned this doctor's not really going to help you, not really that interested. You want your doctor to be talking to you about what ails you, your suffering, your pain. So this is considered one of the great doctors of the spiritual life, and he's interested in what ails us, what the problems are of our lives, and which he defined and didn't define, but he kind of characterized this one word, dukkha, which is often translated into English as suffering. And the suggestion is that if you pay attention to your suffering, that's like sitting at the watering hole. There's a lot of things you can do in your life, a lot of things you can explore, a lot of personal issues you can explore and review your history and your past and what happened to you. You can think about your future and what you might become or what might happen to you. Or you might review all kinds of wonderful philosophical issues, existential issues about the meaning of life and what might happen to you after you die and the nature of God and how the universe was created. And there's a many kind of wide range of things you might think is very important for spiritual life, for your personal life, that you might want to explore. And it's kind of like going out into the plains of Africa, walking around looking for where the solution is for life's problems, for life's suffering. Some of the animals you're looking for might not even exist. You've heard rumors of Bigfoot. And so you go off spending years looking for something like Bigfoot. Maybe Bigfoot doesn't even exist. But it seems very logical, or if you have an intuitive sense, that Bigfoot should exist. And so you have a lot of faith in the possibility, but you actually spend years and years and years traveling, I guess not the plains of savannah, but the forests of the Northwest, looking for Bigfoot. Perhaps these things do exist, particular things we're looking for, but they don't necessarily pertain directly to the issue of suffering. So, for example, someone might be looking for the meaning of life, which is one of the great quests. What's the meaning of life? And some people might go be a philosophy major in college, and they might travel the world over trying to find the meaning of life, the meaning of life. And they might get various answers along the way. And some of the answers they hold on to for a while, and they really work, and they feel quite happy and secure that they know what the meaning of life is. And then for some reason that doesn't hold anymore, and the person then searches for something else. From a Buddhist point of view, of sitting at the watering hole looking at the suffering, you would look at what is it that motivates you to search for the meaning of your life. There might be very good reasons to do it, but it might also arise out of your own anxiety about your life. And anxiety is a kind of suffering. And then Buddhism says, stop and turn around and look at the anxiety itself. And rather than trying to spend years looking for the meaning in order to satisfy the anxiety or calm the anxiety. So look at the anxiety itself and come to terms to it. Look at that fear that might be there, which is a kind of suffering, and resolve it. Buddhist practice is offered as a way of dissolving our fears, and so somehow come to terms with that. And then if the anxiety has gone away, what happens to the fuel for looking for that meaning? You might still want to look for the meaning for life, but it's not driven by the anxiety. Or it might be that once the anxiety that was fueling that quest is gone, then perhaps there's no longer any, you have better things to do with your life. Maybe you notice that, your kids need some help. And so better to help your neighbors or people around you. There are all kinds of things that you might want to do instead. So sitting at the watering hole, sitting at where the suffering occurs. Another example perhaps would be, I don't know much about massage that much. I've had some nice massages in my time. But so maybe this is a little bit of a fantasy to make this example. But say you go to a masseuse for a massage, and the masseuse kind of takes stock of who you are and notices that seemingly the most tense place in your body is your shoulders. So perhaps the masseuse decides it makes sense to start where the most tension is and work on that and relax the tension in the shoulders. And after a while, the shoulders are completely relaxed. And then the masseuse looks around, where else is the tension right now? Oh, now there's a little bit, not as strong anymore, but it's the next strongest tension happened to be in the stomach, in the massage of stomach, then the jaws. And they work their way down from what is most tense to what is more and more subtle, less and less tense, until there's absolutely no more tension in the whole psychophysical being, and you leave just quite happy until you get in your car. So mindfulness meditation, awareness meditation, at times works this way, that it starts with what's coarsest in our life and massages it, works with it, resolves it, deals with it. And then it takes care of what's next coarsest, and the next. And each time it's taking care of where the tension is, the holding, the suffering. And some of that suffering is in our physical body, some of it's in our mind, some of it's in our hearts. But wherever it might be, wherever the strongest is, it's somehow dealt with, or what's most obvious, or what's most kind of on the surface. So some people, when they first sit down to meditate at the end of a busy day, it might simply be physical tension, which is the kind of the most obvious. And they sit down and you feel the tension in your breath and your shoulders, and you sit with it, you're aware of it, and breathe with it, and it settles. And after a while you realize that you're a little bit settled, but now the mind is really busy, and the momentum of the daily concerns are still bombarding your mind. The mind kind of, there's a kind of a grasping in the mind, because certain themes won't leave you alone. Because the mind keeps gravitating towards reviewing that conversation, planning that event next, in the future. And it keeps going in that direction, and it's kind of like a holding, a grasping in the mind that latches on. So once some of the coarser physical tension might have settled, you start being aware of this tension in the mind, the holding, the suffering there. And then bring attention to that, and that kind of maybe settles enough, calms enough, and then you're ready for the next strongest level of tension in your body. And it's more subtle now. And then you kind of follow these things down through the layers until eventually things get taken care of. Now, the bad news about this, which maybe makes it very discouraging, this kind of description, is that the path that you're following is your suffering. You thought you were going to get away from it or be free of it. But you're actually following the track of suffering so that you can actually have less and less. But when you eliminate or get rid of one block of suffering, you don't just live in bliss then. But you go into the next one, which might be more subtle. So just like the masseuse, you know, who doesn't just massage your shoulders and say, great, your shoulders are great, you know, go home. The masseuse, you know, if still has some time left, would then kind of deal with the next place in your body where there might be some tension, hang out there and work for a while. So this idea of going from what's most coarse to what's most refined or most subtle. As people meditate, a lot of their tension, so part of this, looking at the suffering, letting suffering be the water hole, is almost synonymous with letting tension, holding, grasping, contraction, be the water hole where we sit, where we pay attention to, where we seek out. And what it said is that whatever issues really need to be addressed in your life, the real ones, will come to you if you sit at the watering hole of suffering, of tension. Now that's an important teaching because of the tendency we have to get lost in our abstractions, all the ideas we have that we've gotten from society, from teachers, from our family, whatever, about the important things that need to be addressed and taken care of. From the Buddhist point of view, a lot of those things might be misguided and unimportant from the point of view of alleviating suffering. They're kind of misdirected. They keep you at a great distance from really what the core issues really are. In the same way as searching years for the meaning of life is avoiding the core issue, the fact that actually you're afraid. And many times when people ask very abstract, almost scholarly questions in a kind of setting like this, sometimes it's because they would like to know, but sometimes when it seems really kind of very academic, that kind of questions the person asks, it's useful for the teacher to ask, why are you asking? And then they say, oh, it's because of my mother, you know, is about to die. And so I'm wondering about, you know, I'm suffering because of it, and I'm looking for some kind of solution, some kind of understanding of life that kind of makes me feel better about the fact that death is about to happen in my family. And what Buddhist practice would suggest is that rather than looking for some meaning, some explanation, some understanding about the nature of life and reality and rebirth and all that, as a way of kind of feeling some security or some sense of well-being in the face of great crisis, it's possible to turn the mirror of awareness around directly back at the anxiety or fear or suffering that is there. If a person asks an academic question and the teacher responds in an academic way, it's all very interesting, but it maybe never touches the real core of what was fueling that question to begin with. Am I making some sense? So as we sit, then, especially on retreat, we go through these layers of our experience. And we go perhaps from the coarsest to the most refined. Some people are in a hurry in the meditation practice and will try to leapfrog over certain things. It happened to me on the retreat when I was sitting there. I was sitting there, I think, well, I'm going to sit and be with my breath for a while and get concentrated, and which just seems like, you know, that's what we're advertised, that's what's advertised supposed to do there, so it seemed like a reasonable thing to do. So I was sitting there kind of trying to be with my breath, and I noticed that this particular time of being concentrating my breath, I wasn't getting settled. And so I tried harder. And I wasn't getting settled, so I tried harder and I wasn't getting settled. And what I noticed after a while, so it took me a while to realize that a certain frustration and tension was building up within me. I was blind to it because I kept chasing the breath. And finally, I had to let go of the breath and say, what's really going on here? What's really going on? And then I noticed certainly the frustration, but I noticed that there was a certain level of preoccupation in my mind that was really the coarsest activity that was actually going on. And by ignoring it, I was trying to leapfrog over it to try to be at a more refined level before the coarser level was taken care of. So we go through these layers. Now, for many people, one of the very kind of most generally, the widest kind of coarsest, I mean, I say be more careful. For many people, one of the widest or most pervasive categories of issues. Yes, she's sorry. One of the important things that we have to address is what I call our relational self. Buddhism has a lot of teachings about the nature of self and not self, and tends to perplex a lot of people. But I think it's useful to look for this category of relational self, which is a sense of self, the understanding of self, who we are, that arises in relationship to other people. And my understanding is this is something every human being needs to develop in order to be a human being. We're social beings, and we need to fit ourselves into society, into family, and our family and society helps shape who we are not in our core, but who we are in our as a relational being. And a lot of us then, so we're often trying to negotiate our life through the issues and concerns of this relational self. We're trying to improve it, we're trying to defend it, we're trying to present it to other people so they like us, and all kinds of things. But this development of the relational self starts probably at birth, or maybe even before birth. And it's very important that it gets developed in a healthy way. Some of the most pervasive suffering a lot of people have concerns the relational self. And some of it has its genesis very early in life, at a very early age. And I see this very clearly on retreats. I do interviews with people on retreat. And it's fairly common on these retreats that people will start touching into issues that have a genesis in childhood. It isn't that they're doing psychoanalysis and they think, you know, that they've read some book that's wonderful, it's important to go in and analyze and think about and reflect and remember all the details of your childhood. But rather they're sitting there paying attention to their body and their minds and their hearts, trying to be present in the moment, noticing where the holding is, noticing what keeps the mind, the body, the heart from relaxing and releasing. And what becomes obvious after a while is that there's some holding still going on based on some childhood trauma. And as a young parent, I feel I've learned more about parenting by listening to people on retreat talk about how they were misparented, the traumas they went through as children, issues of being abandoned, of not being seen, can shape a person's almost a character, the personality, for the rest of their life, the holding that we carry with us. There was a person on a recent retreat who was sitting there meditating, and she started noticing how anxious and afraid she was. And the fear kept her paralyzed. She couldn't actually breathe very deeply because her breath was held in, her body was held constricted, and she noticed how much physical pain she had. And she thought, you know, it had to do with maybe poor posture, or maybe she didn't exercise enough, or whatever. But I could see her body, how much it was held. So she was sitting there, opening up to this experience in the body, what was held there, and it became more and more frightening, more and more frightening, more and more frightening. So rather than going on retreat and, you know, more and more bliss and calm and relaxation, it was panic and terror started arising for this person. And what had happened was this person had touched in to the utter terror as a three-year-old when her parents decided to go for a three-week vacation and dropped her off at someone's house who she didn't know. And they had a big dog. She was terrified of dogs. And for three weeks for a three-year-old means forever. And this fear and terror and anger at being abandoned was one of the pivotal kind of things that shaped this person's character, this person's personality for much of their life. But it was held there in this tension. If you sit at the watering hole of tension, pay attention to it, eventually that surfaces and shows itself if it's there. And it was very frightening for this person to go through this, but she went through it and felt more relaxed in her body than she'd felt in all her whole life that she could remember by going through it. Sometimes it gets worse before it gets better. You have to be willing sometimes to face the dark night of soul, the darkness within us, in order to become free. Children, when they're born, are, it is obvious to all of us, right, are defenseless. And I believe one of the primary need, one of the primary needs they need is to feel protected, to feel safe, to feel secure, to feel like their needs are going to be met. And for any reason that is not provided in an adequate way, then that fear then becomes often lodged in their body. It often gets lodged in attitude towards life. Attitudes towards, life cannot, other people cannot be trusted. We carry with us attitudes then that are shaped by early childhood experiences. There are some psychoanalysts who will say, argue, that whole philosophies that people formulate, great philosophers, great politicians, and their political views and philosophical views, can be traced to childhood experiences because they're so formative in how we, the attitude by which, the eyes through which we see the world around us. So as we grow up, this relational self gets developed by other people, sometimes in unhealthy ways and sometimes in healthy ways. And our life experiences contribute to it, our family, what they tell us that contribute to us, how they look at us, how they talk to us, the kind of things they respond to us about. I was quite a kind of wake up for me 2 years ago or so when I realized that as I was raising my young child, when I realized how very clearly what a powerful value it was for me, a strong value for me in raising him, that he become independent. And if I hadn't done all my studies that I've done, my mindfulness practice, my Buddhist studies and everything, I probably would have taken that to be natural. That's the way the order of the universe, that individual children should be taught to be independent as they grow up. That's just the way, isn't that the way it is? They should be good individuals and independent. But I lived in enough different cultures and studied enough about different cultures and child rearing and all that to know this is a culturally conditioned view in American society about how you should raise a child. And I was raised with those values from my parents. I was told that. And maybe they're fine values, but they're culturally conditioned values. Then that shape who a child is, who they think about themselves. And that sense of I am an individual belongs to their relational self, because it's a sense of self that arises out of the way people relate to them and train them and teach them how to be. If you go to a country like Japan, you can see how it takes a while to get underneath the skin of Japanese culture. But at some point you'll see that the Japanese are carrying themselves in society with a very different sense of what it's like to be a human person than we in the West are carrying ourselves. When I realized that out in Japan, I was working together with a crew of other people in the monastery, doing the same kind of project for many days in a row. And suddenly I kind of woke up in the middle of this project, this work experience, and I realized I was living in a different universe, was the sense I had that moment. I was operating as if I was an individual among many different individuals, all of us taking care of our own little task. And they were all operating in a universe where they were a unit. They weren't individuals. They were all kind of extensions of each other. And they were much more in touch with each other, flowing with each other, working with each other, in tune with each other, than I could ever imagine anyone could have been. Maybe if you're, you know, on a sports team, maybe you have that sense, perhaps, if you're really good. But even, is it Bill Jackson? Phil Jackson had a hard time getting some of his players to understand that, because the individualism was so powerful. I want to be the best, you know. I want to shine on the basketball court and stand out. So it starts very early. It's a relational self that we develop, and it can look like it's the most natural thing in the world. So as we develop, it develops both in healthy and unhealthy ways. A couple of other examples. When I was very simple, innocent things, maybe, how we can take things for granted. When I was in seventh grade, I took an art class. And at some point, I was drawing my left hand, and the teacher came over to me and said, very matter-of-factly, like this is the way the universe is, you have no artistic ability. Can you imagine telling that to a seventh grader? Well, I had no interest in being an artist. You know, I had no thought about it. I said, that's the way it is. I have no artistic ability. that's, you know, I was defined. And that's the way it was. I carried that with me for a long time, for the next probably number of years, until things shifted around that particular definition. Society defines other members of society all the time, sometimes in horrendous ways. Women know how it's like to be defined. Minorities, ethnic minorities, racial minorities, know how awful it is to be defined by other people in society. And sometimes it gets internalized in all of us in ways in which we carry ourselves. We don't often know, we don't even see the ways in which we define other people. I didn't see until I kind of, that wake-up call, that I was defining my son in a certain way around being an individual, independent. I bet that seventh grade teacher had no idea she was defining who I thought I was in that little statement. So we do that to each other, and we create tremendous suffering for each other because of it. As we sit and meditate, any of the ways in which we are contracted or holding or suffering because of the relational self becomes highlighted. And it's one of the things that we have to work through, relax, let go of, and because all suffering, the path of practice is to release all suffering and not to have it. And to the degree in which we suffer because of relational self, that suffering has to somehow or other be dealt with and looked at. There's no way around that. There are sometimes temporary bypasses. But eventually, sooner or later, if the liberation is going to be thorough, any places of holding, of clinging, of suffering has to be dealt with. And then my suggestion here is tonight is that for many of us, one of the primary areas of our suffering has to do with this relational self. So that's part of the reason why psychotherapy has been such an important help in many people's lives, because psychotherapy knows really well, understands well, that's the kind of very important field of psychotherapy, is the relational self. I don't think they use that word, that term, but they explore, you know, the dynamics of your family and society and all kinds of things, and help you understand those kinds of things. In the teachings of the Buddha, as I understand it, it's not good enough to simply have a healthy relational self. It's certainly an important thing to have. It's not to be, you know, belittled to have that. But according to teaching, one of the challenges of the teachings of the Buddha is that even a healthy sense of relational self will have some kind of suffering as part of it. As long as we're holding onto some definition of who we are, any kind of definition of who we are, there is some kind of suffering, or anxiety, maybe is a better word, or restlessness that goes with that. And perhaps because any way which we want to define ourselves that's fixed goes against the impermanence of self. The relational self is an impermanent phenomena. It changes all the time in context and situations. And if those of you who might have grown up in different countries, different cultures, might have noticed how your sense of self changes from one culture to the other. I grew up in different cultures, and when I can't speak Italian as well as I used to now, but there was an Italian Gil. And there were certain ways of expressing myself, of being, that only existed in Italian. And certain ways of being that only existed in English. And I remember kind of in college, you know, missing and wanting to express certain things, you know, and a part of me, and it would only come out in Italian. Because you know, that's who I was. I remember a friend of mine, I'm Norwegian originally, and I grew up some in Norway. And I had a friend when I was 20 in Norway, who a Norwegian, who I was living with him on his farm. And he had traveled in America in the late 60s and gone commune hopping in America as a young man, teenager, I think. And he had learned his English on American communes in the 1960s, hippie communes. And so his whole beingness, the whole way he was when he spoke English, was like this really, really laid-back hippie man, yeah, everything cool, whatever. You know, it was really fun to be with him. So, and we spoke mostly English together because his wife was American. But But he was Norwegian. I'm Norwegian. I speak Norwegian. So sometimes we talk Norwegian together. And he grew up in Oslo in a kind of very formal, upper-class, stiff environment, kind of prudish. Norwegians, my cousin was visiting today from Norway, and he defined Norwegians as prudish. So he's Norwegian. So anyway, so my friend, you know, he was kind of stiff, upper class, reserved, conservative background. When he spoke Norwegian, I actually didn't like him. It was like a different self was there. So people who go from culture to culture can see this different. So it changes. The self you are now will change depending on the input you get over time and the information you get. So any definition, even a healthy one of self, that's fixed in some way, involves some anxiety or restlessness in holding it in place. So the Buddha's challenge is that even the relational self has some anxiety that needs some tension, suffering that needs to be let go of, which means that the relational self has to, in some sense, be let go of. Maybe not permanently, but if you really want to discover the possibility of being at deep peace and deep happiness within yourself, you have to let go of any concern, preoccupation with the relational self. The relational self, if you're only trying to negotiate the relational self, trying to fix it and adjust it and get a better one and defend it and do all these things, it's like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. It's a nice thing to do when you're just leaving port. But sooner or later, you know, it's like you realize, forget about the deck chairs. And ship's going down. So is there an alternative to the relational self? And I believe this is one of the very radical offerings of the Buddhist tradition, is that there is an alternative, not an alternative as a substitute for the relational self. It's always going to be with you. You always have to live in it. But an alternative, in the sense of, you can take a vacation. You can find that there's a more fundamental foundation for who you are that is not relational. And when you know that foundation, then you have a different relationship to the relational self. You won't be so anxious about fixing it. It won't be so absolutely imperative that the relational self be a certain way, because you know something actually more profound and more central, deeper. And what is that that's deeper? For, in a very un-Buddhist way, un-Buddhist terminology, kind of as a temporary word, temporary expression, we could say there's an independent self. There's a self which is independent of all relationships. A sense of being, a sense of consciousness, a sense of awareness, which doesn't exist with any definite, doesn't define itself or need to be defined in any kind of way by the world around us, by what other people tell us who we are, or our experiences, or our life history, or whatever. And so the independent self. So we let go, we hang out of suffering, and we let go. And at some point, at a very subtle, refined levels, you might realize that any sense of self, any idea of self, any attempt to define the self represents some lingering aspect of suffering and clinging. And this gets very subtle, because there are some phenomenal, from Buddhist point of view, and please take it as that, there are some very convincing definitions of self that people will settle back to when they get into very deep meditative states, kind of mystical states. One of them, for example, is that the self doesn't exist. That's a common Buddhist one. Buddhists like that one. Another one is that the self is universal, is cosmic. The self and the cosmos and the universe are one. The world and everything is one. Everything's interconnected. There is no self, there is no small self. The individual personal self is overcome by the transpersonal self, that self which is connected to everything around it, kind of a mystical state of sorts. Or the self is that which knows our experience. The awareness that knows everything is self. or the relational self is not the true self, but that which tries to create a relational self, that is the real self. Or that which is aware of the relational self, that's the real self. What the Buddha suggested is that any attempt to define the self any kind of way entails some kind of clinging and suffering. Even those wonderful things. You might have your own favorite one that you've quite cherished. And whether it's true or not, your particular one, if you're going to follow the path of mindfulness to the utter freedom and independence that it can offer you, you have to let go of those definitions also. And you can't look at life, you can't look at yourself and have any definition of what's here. And for some people, that's the final terror. No definition, you know, just be that naked with nothing. You don't have to be in a hurry to do this. All you have to do, and you don't have to kind of figure out philosophically whether this is a good idea or not. All you have to do is sit at the watering hole and be very respectful and compassionate and kind to all the animals that come there. And if it's the big elephants that come, be wise how you sit near the watering hole. Treat with great respect the elephants, but attend to the elephants. If it's the itty-bitty little ants that come along, very subtle, and that's what comes to the watering hole, pay attention to that. If after the subtle, very refined ants have been there for a long time, or the insects, you know, insects in Africa are just so pristine and beautiful, and this is great, you know, and man, I'm really down at the core. And then suddenly, a human being shows up. Oh no, not a human being. I thought it finished with all that. The human being, relationship problems and all that. I thought I was finished with all that. I'm dealing with the subtle insects. What's wrong with me? I've backtracked in my spiritual life. Don't be concerned one bit about what it is that comes to your watering hole. Don't measure it or judge it or compare it to other people's animals or to animals you've had before or better. The animal that comes to your watering hole, if you're just standing at the watering hole and watching, the animal that comes to your watering hole is the one that's supposed to come. That's the way it is. You don't have to judge it or think it's wrong. It's your animal. So enjoy it. Offer it your presence. Teach that animal that it can trust you, that you're kind. Don't try to chase it away or kill it or drown it in the water or, you know, whatever. But whatever animal comes, be very respectful. And learn that through the respectful attention and awareness that simply sees very clearly how things are, that you'll become free. After all, one of the things I've learned is that, especially for children, that being seen and being loved are virtually, if not the same, synonymous. Children who aren't seen don't feel like they're loved and grow up problematic relational selves. And I think it's still true as adults. The simple act of seeing. What we're asked to do when the animals come to our watering hole is simply to look at them and see them. And see them and see them and see them. And try to avoid the temptations of chasing away the scary ones and taking home the cuddly ones. Just look and look and look. So may you all get a taste of that independent self that cannot exist if you call it an independent self. Thank you.